Welcome to the Sizzle Podcast. I am Dr. Joe Taylor. In every one of our episodes, I bring my psychological lens along, and the guests and I have a warm conversation about a hot topic. Today, I'm speaking with Alex Holmes. Alex is a therapeutic coach and a trainee psychotherapist. He's written the book Time to Talk and is host of Alex Holmes podcast. And I'm really excited to speak to Alex because his work focuses on masculinity and male mental health.
I really wish boys were taught how to love, what love meant from an early age and what that looks like. And I think a lot of boys are changing nowadays. Gen Z are just gonna be so different.
Gen love. And I feel like it's a really important, timely topic. So let's get into it. Alex, it's so lovely to have a chance to speak to you. And there are so many things I feel like we could talk about. And maybe a nice way to provide a bit of a foundation for our chat is to just hear a little bit about what you're working on, what you're thinking about, and that can kind of serve as a jumping off point for all the things you might talk about next.
So currently I am working on building out some, I wouldn't say programs, but deepening my practice with working with men, generally. I'm weighing up the idea whether to work across gender, but at the moment I'm doing a lot of work and research around what I call probably the five pillars, the five obstacles that a lot of men have with their mental health and well-being. So that's looking at shame, vulnerability, worthiness, imperfection, and courage, and trying to understand how we engage men in this conversation around those four areas to allow them to then step into themselves a lot more. And the most interesting part of this for me is the shame part. I think it covers a lot of ground. I think it builds and makes the foundation for a lot of men's lives. And the way that we navigate ourselves as we go through from childhood to adolescence and young adulthood, and even through our life stages at both work or as parents, if we are fortunate enough to become one. And it's just because it's just a really deep area that I don't think a lot of people spend much time in. As much as I've read or as much as I've looked at so far. And because it's hard to talk about. It's hard to talk about it on a contemporary level sometimes. I think that we dance around the word, I feel, a lot of the time. We dance around shame. I mean, I've mentioned shame to older men who flinch at the word shame. And it's actually quite, I wouldn't say alarming, but I just find it jarring sometimes because I'm thinking it's a word. Here's a definition of it. Like, let's understand it and unpack it, sort of thing, you know? But we spend a lot of time both acknowledging shame and ignoring it. So we live in this really weird paradox as men sometimes. So doing a lot of work in that area, trying to figure it all out bit by bit. And this is life work, man. This is heart work right now. It's doing the stuff that I love to do, and it's navigating through painful areas, right, to find answers. It's my own self-exploration too, so you know, it won't be for nothing.
I love that, life work and heart work. That's such a powerful quote. And taken me back to being a child, actually, and conversations that I've had with my mum, who was quite an interesting mix of ex-midwife and then therapist for, you know, the end of her career. And we'd have casual conversations about the patriarchy, you know, when I was in primary school. And I, so, something she said to me that I heard again recently, but I've never checked, I've never looked into, it's just this idea that when women were asked what they most feared, they said being killed. And when men were asked what they were most scared of, they said being laughed at. And it's one of those bits of information that's just stayed with me from childhood through to the present day. And when you were talking about shame and the amount of effort we can put into ignoring it as well as talking about it, and the way that those older people flinched, it just made me think, wow, yeah, there is that real poignancy to the feeling that you might have done something wrong, or that someone feels something about you. And yeah, it's quite visceral when you say the word shame. I can almost feel it. And I wonder how you help people access that. Like, how do you go from the flinch to moving towards something a bit more hopeful or productive when you're working with people?
Well, a lot of my practice, I mean, I'm trained in CBT and trained in the cognitive behavioral therapies. I'm an integrative practitioner, right? But I really like the behavioral therapies. And those are very, very popular areas of behaviorism. It's quite popular, I suppose, for men a lot of the time. There's a solution at the end, there's a method, there's a process, there's things you can do, etc. and whatnot. But I look at it and I just think to myself that, you know, it's not the only way to connect with men. These are really deep experiences. But I guess it all starts with, and you probably know this as in your field as well, it's providing a room of safety to allow these men to be brave, right? To allow people to be brave. And it takes a while. I mean, a lot of my clients, we take three or four sessions to really get to the heart of what it is that is causing a lot of these emotional upsets and emotional disturbances. And a lot of it is down to the emotional connections that they have with friends, family, and other members, and other relationships that they want to feel. They want to feel whole in. They want to feel like they're belonging and whatnot. And a big thing that is holding them back is that feeling of shame that is causing them to act a particular way, respond in particular ways. And so how do we access that? You know, it's just about assessing where they're at and then going from there. And I think that, especially with acceptance and commitment therapy, looking at the behaviors and, you know, and the feelings, and figuring out how to think better so you can feel better, so you can then do better, is also a way in, because you start with, this is the problem, let's try to navigate how you can feel better about that, and then what you can do next. And we start to uncover a whole host of things that come up. So yeah, I mean, it takes time. Men take time. Men are very, as much as we require external validation, we are very internal people when it comes to our problems and our pains. I think it's that fear that the outside world won't respect who we are, what we do, how we navigate the world.
I'm just thinking about the smile you had when you were talking about behavioral approaches and how they can be, they can maybe be quite popular among men. And I was just thinking about that formulaic or predictable trajectory and the way that that might link to control. And if I'm trying to avoid feelings of shame, I could see how that control or perceived control might be quite appealing. And you got, before we spoke, I just jotted down some of the famous role models that I feel like men have had, just anecdotally. So this is, you know, this isn't based upon any research. This is just off the top of my head from chats with my particular friendship group or, you know, what I see on social media. But like the people that come to mind are people like Joe Rogan, Andrew Tate, Tony Robbins, David Goggins. You know, you've got to conquer your inner bitch, like that narrative. Real like threat based, there's this weakness inside, you must work hard to overcome it, type narratives. And I wonder what your thoughts are on the people that I've mentioned, because it does seem like they've got a very similar message there about hard work, a formula to success, and this kind of inner, and maybe just to finish that thought, like this inner secret or weakness that you've got to try and navigate somehow.
I will say that Can't Hurt Me was one of the most transformative books for me this year, right? And David Goggins is absolutely loco. He is, and he even says so himself. He's like, he is not a normal person. Like, all the stuff he did is unbelievable. Unbelievable things that he's doing. I think that anything that allows you to think differently about yourself with a positive regard is important for you to hold on to. And David Goggins isn't even only just speaking to men, he's speaking to everybody. He's saying, if you want to change the way that you operate and navigate in life, here are several. Here, there's just a way. You just have to just quiet there's the self-doubt, the negative talk, the this, the that, and the other. You have to really get ahead of motivation. You have to do all of this different stuff. And it definitely, when I think of him, I think of somebody who has had a storied history of extreme trauma. I don't know if you've read the book where you've heard his story, but I listened to it. It was an audiobook. Interesting. Sorry, I'm going to go on a bit of a slight tangent, but I'm coming back to it. Within the book, it's he reads it, but he's reading it alongside his ghostwriter. And throughout several intervals in the chapter, it kind of breaks off into a conversation about what has just been said. So you get to know the story a lot deeper and in a different way. And what he provides is this idea of how we build routine, how we develop ourselves, how we transform ourselves from the inside out, and how we allow ourselves to then regain that fire within ourselves that is somehow diminished by the thoughts, feelings, and actions of other people. So you can only control the thoughts, feelings that you have about yourself, and that impacts the actions that you exhibit. So some are men, and in the culture we have, a lot of men can only be spoken to in a particular way, and which is army, which is shouting, which is, you know, diminishing the weakness within somebody. That's the only way to kind of prove and show dominance. And I think that the men that you mentioned, of all of those men, I remember the other list of people, but of the few that you mentioned, I remember I would only spend time listening to David Goggins personally, because he doesn't come from it from a perspective of, I'm a man, this is what a man has to do. Because he's had the experience with his father. His father was awful, right? He comes from it from a, you have a job to do as a human being. And in order for you to be the best person and the best version of yourself, start here. The rest is up to you, but start here. And I think that that's an important understanding of how we lead men and how men lead one another and how we lead ourselves. Because it's not necessarily about being so directive and authoritarian, but it is about building a routine for yourself. And then allowing yourself to create the life that you need and that you really want to exhibit. But some of the other men that you mentioned, and they aren't necessarily coming at it from a perspective of, this is what you can do to better the lives of other people and the people around you. They're coming at it from a, this is fact, quote unquote, and this is what you have to be if you want to be a dominant man or an alpha male or any of those monikers that require you to punch down people rather than actually really look at yourself and think about what's happening here. And this is what David Goggins offers. He offers you to get on with it and go through the pain, but he also offers you to reflect and work on what is actually occurring on there, so you can then fight your demons in the best way. So I think what we have an issue with at the moment is the messaging and who we listen to and who the current teachers are. I don't know if that answers your question. I actually can't remember what it was.
I mean, well, we're talking about David Goggins now, which I actually love. And I appreciate your distinction because I take a lot from some of the stuff that David Goggins talks about as well. I think that he's a really interesting person. It's funny hearing you talk about the messaging, because suffering isn't PC. Like, suffering isn't PG. It's really hard, and I suppose something that I feel Goggins does do well is get alongside that suffering to understand it, and that I think I really appreciate from a place of compassion, in terms of, you know, can we really understand the distress in order to, and be with the distress in order to try and make things better. You've made me think about some research I did in a boxing club, and it was young people, a mix, but mostly boys and young men, but there was a mix there, and it was incredibly useful, and I love being there, and you know, some of the things that were particularly, you know, I'm a boxer, like I'm definitely biased, but some of the things that I really like about how they worked is they were really explicit about trying to take messages out of the gym and into life, and the young people were so glowing about how it helped with things like, you know, school, work, friendships, all this kind of stuff. But something that I did leave with that made me feel a bit uncomfortable was that there was this narrative about never losing, always, you know, being a champion in life, fighting until you win. And I don't know, I mean, you might disagree, but I feel like some of the ways that David Goggins talks is kind of against weakness. And my worry is, you know, you build this routine and it's useful in, let's say, you know, 80 or 90% of life, but there might be moments where it doesn't work or it crumbles, and then what are you left with? And my fear is that you then end up back with shame, because my palace of routine didn't work that I've slowly created. But anyway, that's just off the top of my head, drawing a few things together. I don't know what you make of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, Yeah, and like he doesn't like in his story and his own story, he fails multiple times in catastrophic ways in some instances. And I'm talking breaking legs and still trying to run and doing all of it, putting on a huge amount of weight and not taking himself seriously when he's supposed to be doing X, Y, and Z. So he's failed in many different ways. His messaging is basically know what you want to do, try. If you fail, get yourself up and keep going. Right, that's his basic messaging. I think that there is a certain level of importance, because in my book, I wrote a chapter called Real Men Don't Fail, the myth of success and how we can win our life together and all this different stuff. And I would probably go back if I could, and I'll probably add more to that and think to myself, like, as much as life is a collaborative experience, we are within a system that actively wants us to compete. And in order for us to, or in order for us to progress to the next stage in our lives, we have to be able to be competitive within the context of ourselves, but also with what the demands of the system is. So we have to understand what it is that we want and how we want it and what that looks like. But again, my only caveat to most of these things is, as long as it doesn't harm yourself and others in the process. There's nothing wrong with being determined. There's nothing wrong with being focused. There's nothing wrong with outworking somebody. There's nothing wrong with doing what you can to make sure that you succeed at your goal, and you set them and you think, okay, cool, I want to do this now, and just set your mind to something and then go for it. Nothing wrong with that. Again, as long as you are not causing harm to both yourself and others, then that's the important caveat that we always forget when we are telling, when we are kind of distilling these messages to young boys. We always forget that, you know, like, so, I mean, I don't want to offend you, but I have a slight thing against boxing. I'm not 100% for it. I'm not 100% against it. I'm kind of in the middle with it. I see it as a valuable tool for defense, for sure. I also see it as a very dangerous sport for physically, and I don't know if I have the trust of certain coaches to distill that level of balance in a lot of kids. But what you said was important, because the coaching that you saw and what you witnessed did have that. Which is why I was, in my mind, I was like, yeah, that's good. But I've watched Ray Donovan and I've seen that boxing club, right? And I was not, I don't know if you know what Ray Donovan is, but it's a show. And it's like this Irish-American family in LA, all the way from Boston. And one of the brothers has a boxing club. And it's just like this really dysfunctional family running this boxing club. So you can kind of get the picture of, you know, people using violence as a communication tool, sort of thing. Like, it's just, which it is, can be. But yeah, I struggle with it a little bit.
I mean, so do I. And, you know, I've been in dysfunctional boxing gyms, and I think it is really complicated, and it's certainly not something I'd recommend for people. But I do think that, you know, I suppose we're talking a lot about men and masculinity. Like, I do think that violence is human. I think that societally we also have a really kind of complicated relationship with violence and play violence. You know, we see it a lot all around us, and it's also very heavily penalized in terms of the acts. But, you know, just speaking personally, I think that the things that I've got from boxing are having to navigate fear and developing real intimate trust with men. Well, I mean, actually with everyone, although I have developed it with women too, but I think the people that popped into my head, kind of flashbacks to sparring, it was mostly men that were bigger than me, actually. But there's this moment that I experienced where you, without language, are moderating the amount of force that you use. And you know that you could really hurt each other, but you're there to learn. And so, I mean, this isn't all gyms. This is like, this is the ideal experience that I have got, you know, got learning from. But that kind of dance of how do we find what is acceptable to each of us and not exceed that is, yeah, it feels really personal. And when you find partners that you can work with in that over time, it does make you feel incredibly close. And the delicacy of looking after each other and knowing when to push each other, it's so hard to articulate. But those are some of the things that I have found valuable with the process of boxing. And I also know it's really complicated. You know, I've had endless conversations about all of the harm, the correlations between, you know, boxing and suicide, you know, the correlations between experiences of all sorts of abuse and participation in boxing. You know, this is a really, like, complicated and in some cases a really distressing picture. But I appreciate you mentioning that you had issues with boxing, because it's something that, even though I love it, I also am really wary of as well.
It's something my granddad made sure all his sons did. They all boxed. And my dad, like, I never boxed growing up. I did martial arts. That was something, it was still within that area, but it was more, this is an ancient art of mindfulness. It's like, it's just something that I see. And even like the boxing that was on last weekend, I just tune out. And then, it's just not something that I do understand how men, I do think it's a requirement that men must learn how to defend themselves, especially in a world where men are attacked very often by other men. So it's like a double-edged thing. Like, you, I'm like, yes, learn how to defend yourself. If boxing is the way, go for it. Sure. And the only way that you learn really how to fight is by fighting someone. And that's by sparring. So, you know, until you know what it's like to be hit in the head or even the face, you're not really going to take fighting seriously, are you? I suppose. So, yeah. I'm coming around to it slowly.
So we got into boxing because you mentioned your book. And do you know what? I was looking at the reviews and the words that came up again and again were connection and love. And I thought that was so... It was really nice to read, but I thought it was really striking that a book that was, discussing things like, you know, being a real man, might have people leaving reviews that talked about connection and love. And I suppose writers have different relationships with reviews, but I wonder how it feels to hear me kind of pick out connection and love as words that stood out from the reviews.
It feels sobering, I suppose. It feels like, I think that people, that's what they pulled out from it, I suppose. But it's part of, it's in the subtitle of the book, I mean, think about love, belonging, and connection. I mean, I'm ultimately happy about that, to be fair. Taking me a while to detach myself from which is why I probably feel a bit, sound a bit distant from it, but I had to detach myself from the book and the material experiences that surround yourself as a writer when it comes to publishing your work. I had to fully sell myself to allow it to just do what it had to do. Interestingly enough, most of the comments I have received have been from women. If there have been men who connected with the book, not many have told me so. But I would like to think that it has done what it needs to do. It's begun to start the conversation around the emotional impacts and stuff. And I also have deep compassion for myself with the book too, because I began writing it before I trained as a coach, before I trained as a psychotherapist, before I was even mentally health first aid trained. I was just literally writing about what I thought I knew as a journalist from that perspective. And it's actually really interesting to think about sometimes. I think about, wow, I actually wrote that book 2-3 years ago.
Yeah, I was curious because we haven't talked about stoicism yet, but when I was looking at your website, it kind of came through as one of the pillars, or maybe not pillars, maybe one of the ways of explaining how you work or some of your influences. And I don't know if that's something that still feels relevant to your work, and if not, why not? And if so, yeah, I'm curious about what attracted you to it.
I'm attracted to it simply because I love philosophy. I spent a lot of time in existentialism, and it's a very, very dark road to go down for me personally. There would be a point where I'd be wearing black and white, all black, and just being like, nothing matters, being really nihilistic. I stumbled across stoicism through the typical means, through the Daily Stoic, through Ryan Holiday, through that kind of avenue. And then I just began to read into it myself, started to pick up other books. And I started to look at how important it was or is for stoicism to have the core virtues as part of how you operate and live your life. And I think that's so important to start thinking about how we live our lives. And I remember reading something somewhere, and I can't remember where it was, but you know, it's just judging by the kind of search results that I received, I was probably thinking how to fix my life, sort of, you know, something like that. And somebody had written somewhere, have a philosophy. And in my training, I noticed quite quickly that a lot of the theories and the practices were based or started from some sort of philosophical idea. And then like CBT, stoicism, you know, existential psychotherapy, existentialism, you know, I mean, so we've got kind of areas that have kind of distilled themselves down into practice in particular ways. And I started just looking into it, and the virtues that are presented with stoicism are easily transferable and applicable today as they were a whole millennia, although how many of the years before Christ, BC, long time ago, yeah. And it just helped me articulate how I, when I'm looking at a lot of men's behaviors and I'm looking at a lot of men's attitudes to life and the way that we, you know, we struggle with depths of despair, I would say low self-esteem, low confidence in a lot of areas. I'd say the way we operate and navigate ourselves in our families and in our romantic lives and the kind of caricatures that are painted and shown to us in the news, especially as a black man in the news, and how on the in the media generally or in real everyday life, kind of just the things I was just noticing about myself, about my father, my cousins or whatever. I was just looking at that and then comparing it to the four, to the virtues in Stoicism, which are wisdom, courage, temperance, and justice. I think those are the four. Well, I feel like there's five. Can't remember. Wisdom, courage, temperance, and justice, I think. And when I'm doing talks with young people, with young boys, I do a lot of talks around what it means to be a good man. And we start to have these deep conversations about what that looks like, why it's important, who it's important for, where does that fit within these virtues that we have. Stoicism is all about how we contribute to society, how we contribute to life, how we are good people going forward. And I just distill that down to, how are we good men? How are we being good? Are we operating a life of intellectual curiosity and learning lessons and being guided in that way? Do we have wisdom? Oh, the other one's courage. Are we being courageous in that? You know, are we learning the difference between doing too much, taking too much, overdoing it? So are we, do we understand our own temperance? You know, are we being fair? Are we being fair to people and to situations and to ourselves and to things? Are we operating a life of fairness, which is obviously justice? Is that something that we are doing? And when I was observing, I just looking at it and thinking, when, you know, we're not always doing that. And a lot of people aren't navigating the world with like their virtues or their values or their things like guiding them. Some people are just out here freewheeling, like, which is fair. But at the same time, it's just nice to sit back and think, at what point am I overdoing this alcohol? And is it causing me joy or discomfort? You know? At what point are the vices holding me back from being the best version of myself that I can possibly be? Doesn't mean you have to live a life of chastity and doing all these things. But it does mean, having a semblance of what you can control within you. So I use that alongside CBT because I feel like it's not always nice. Like, sometimes a lot of people don't want to hear the science. They don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear, oh, you're thinking this way. Because some people just want to, you know, they want it to be philosophical. They want it to be a metaphor so that they can operate within the metaphor. And a lot of my work is through storytelling because I'm trained as a hypnotherapist as well. So I delve into the storytelling to create the metaphor, to create the story, to create understanding. Some people need the journey. They need to be, they need to experience it in that way too.
Yeah, I'm really struck by the way that you're talking with lots of men. You're talking with lots of boys as well. And it's getting me thinking about developmental stages and kind of how, yeah, how boys grow up into men. And I'm curious to know whether you've got any thoughts about experiences you wish that boys had more universally, or, you know, social influences. I don't want to be too leading, but yeah, if you could kind of click your fingers and make something accessible to boys across England, I don't know.
I really wish boys were taught how to love and what love meant from an early age, how to engage in meaningful relationships from an early age and what that looks like. And I think a lot of boys are changing nowadays. The ones that are growing up and coming up, the generation beneath Gen Z are just gonna be so different.
Gen love.
Gen love. They, you know, I want them to know what it's like to have a nurturing male role model that isn't their father or a relative that's related to them. I want them to know safety in other men, which isn't one of what's the word? Obligation or fear. I want them to know how to be accountable to both themselves and other people, because as a man, you are going to be accountable to other people and hold other people accountable too. I think that is kind of a requirement, which I think is what we're really struggling with now. There is a lack of accountable men out there of the time. Like it or not, we get away with a lot of BS. And I think that would be something that I would love to see. And that's something, that's the conversations I would love to kind of work on and work through. Just to be able to see more men in healthcare, in education, in administration, in literacy, making, like, you know, really kind of disrupting those areas. Male nurses, male nursery teachers, male primary school teachers, you know, just making sure that there is a space for us to know what is possible, to have an empathetic skill set. Obviously, empathy as a skill is not for everybody. But it's something that will definitely be so much useful in the future of work and the way that we navigate as humans.
I mean, you got me imagining a different world with that description. And I suppose I didn't want to make any assumptions. I'm wondering what the results of all of that would be when you think about, you know, Gen Love, and they've received all of this magical influence. Like, what would that lead to on the societal or individual level?
And I build many a discontent from my kind of personal philosophy and my ideals as to what it means and what it looks like. I don't mind disrupting the gender norms, because you be a man on your own terms. It doesn't matter. I mean, we've had this conversation. I mean, I'm watching Scrubs. I mean, I'm rewatching Scrubs, right? And there's a conversation where one of the doctors is dating a male nurse, and then there's all of these, like, I know it's the point of the episode, but she's dating a male nurse, and everyone's like, and his name is Paul Flowers, and they're just like, oh my God, he's a male nurse, it's a woman's job, da-da-da-da, all this kind of thing. Or when the woman nurse is, you know, being guided into working in gynecology, because that's just where all the women doctors end up being, and all this different stuff. And it's just, we've been having these conversations for far too long. I've just been like, why is it being portrayed in a 20-year-old sitcom? 20 years on, and we're still having this conversation still. We've been having this conversation for like almost 100 years now around the nature of men, nature of women, what that looks like, men doing this, women doing that. And the fact we're arguing about it, because there must be something, it must be as fluid as it's supposed to be, because it can't be contained. So it just makes me feel like there's young people out there who will grow up. I really just want them to grow up to have a positive sense of self. If they want to become a nurse or a women's football coach or I don't know, what's this, or anything that's a tradition that is counter to your gender, you know, within the physical capabilities of whatever that role is, why can't you do it? My question, I want to see more equitable families, more equitable households. There will always be power imbalances, but equity should always be there. You know, there will be someone leading. It will. I don't see, you know, there's always a co-pilot. So I don't see how that could change anytime soon. But as far as goals and setting them and moving forward, that tends to be men. But I just don't like seeing any, as I said, I don't like seeing punching down. I don't see, again, I don't want it to harm themselves or harming others. That's just my caveat for all of these things. That's what I see. I don't know if I'll ever see it, but it's what I'm working for coming up after me.
It's been so nice to talk with you and to delve into your work and into your thinking and practice around men and mental health. And I suppose I'm curious about what the future holds. Where you're hoping to take things over the next few years. It might all be like a secret, but there might be some teasers you can give.
I don't like speaking too much about the stuff that I plan to do because it means I've got to be held accountable to it. However, I'm liable to change. I'm very airy. So I'll be like, oh, okay, I like that. Very blighty. However, I am very serious about this work. And I want to do more with my podcast, with my writing, with my clients and in practice. I want to do more there, and I want to do more speaking on the whole, delving deep and unpacking these really big topics and distilling them into, you know, manageable chunks so that people can take stock of the little things and kind of really build themselves up. And there's so much more to come this year, Joe. I'm just taking a beat. I'm just trying to enjoy the summer before I knuckle down over the winter. I'm very much a hibernator. As soon as the clocks go back, I'm just not going to be seeing for a while. I'm just going to be like, you know, Alex is out of office.
I love that. Annual rhythms. And I'll put a link to your book, your podcast. But if people want to get in touch with you when you're not hibernating, where's the best place to find you?
I would always be on an email. Don't worry about that. Go to my website, alexholmes.co, and just connect with me in any way that makes sense. I love seeing my emails coming through from my website. So that's nice. It's a nice feeling because it means people are going there. however, if you don't want to do that, then Instagram is where you'll find me generally commenting on life, or LinkedIn. Again, it's all the same. Everything's on the website, so you can have a look there. But and just even if you hear this and you think to yourself, actually I want to ask him some questions, I'm taking questions for the podcast now as well, so feel free, my little cherubs. share with me.
You've been listening to the Sizzle podcast. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best thing you can do to help is to subscribe to the Substack. And that way you'll get all new episodes straight to your email. And you'll be first up for articles, resources, and lots of other goodies. And also to share it, you know, send the podcast to people that you think might enjoy it. Catch you next time on the Sizzle podcast.